The Bull of Rome. Chapter 1. Character of Maximilian. A new actor was about to appear on the stage. God designed to bring the Wittenberg monk face to face with the most powerful monarch that had appeared in Christendom since the days of Charlemagne. He selected a prince in the vigor of youth, and to whom everything seemed to announce a long reign, a prince whose scepter extended over a considerable part of the old world, and even the new, so that, according to a celebrated saying, the sun never went down on his vast dominions, and to him he opposed that lowly reformation, begun in the secluded cell of a convent at Erfurt by the anguish and the sighs of a poor monk. The history of this monarch and of his reign was destined, it would seem, to teach the world an important lesson. It was to show the nothingness of all the strength of man when it presumes to measure itself with the weakness of God. If a prince, a friend to Luther, had been called to the imperial throne, the success of the Reformation might have been ascribed to his protection. If even an emperor opposed to the new doctrines, but yet a weak ruler, had worn the diadem, the triumph of this work might have been accounted for by the weakness of the monarch. But it was the haughty conqueror at Pavia who was destined to veil his pride before the power of God's word, and the whole world beheld the man, who found it an easy task to drag Francis I a prisoner to Madrid, obliged to lower his sword before the son of a poor miner. The Emperor Maximilian was dead, and the electors had met at Frankfurt to choose a successor. This was an important event for all Europe under the existing circumstances. All Christendom was occupied with this election. Maximilian had not been a great prince, but his memory was dear to the people. They were delighted to call to recollection his presence of mind and his good nature. Luther used often to converse with his friends about him, and one day related the following anecdote of this monarch. A mendicant was once following him and begging alms, calling him brother. "For," said he, "we are both descended from the same father, Adam." "I am poor," continued he, "but you are rich, and you ought therefore to help me." The emperor turned round at these words and said to him, "There is a penny for you. Go to all your other brothers, and if each one gives you as much, you will be richer than I am." It was not a good-natured Maximilian that was destined to wear the imperial crown. The times were changing. Men of overweening ambition were about to dispute the throne of the emperors of the West. A strong hand was to grasp the reins of the empire, and long and bloody wars were on the point of succeeding a profound peace. Three kings claimed the crown of the Caesars from the assembly at Frankfurt. A youthful prince, grandson of the last emperor, born in the first year of the century, and consequently 19 years old, appeared first. His name was Charles, and he was born at Ghent. His paternal grandmother, Mary, daughter of Charles the Bold, had bequeathed to him Flanders and the rich domains of Burgundy. His mother, Joanna, daughter of Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, and wife of Philip the Emperor Maximilian's son, had transmitted to him the united crowns of the two Spains, Naples, and Sicily, to which Christopher Columbus had recently added a new world. His grandfather's death now put him in possession of the hereditary states of Austria. If Charles had grown up under free and Christian influences, he would perhaps have been one of the most meritorious princes recorded in history. But politics absorbed his whole life and blighted his naturally amiable character. If Charles had grown up under free and Christian influences, he would perhaps have been one of the most meritorious princes recorded in history. But politics absorbed his whole life and blighted his naturally amiable character. The youthful Charles, not content with the scepters he already grasped in his hand, aspired to the imperial dignity. "It is a beam of sunshine that casts a splendor upon the house on which it falls," said many. "But stretch forth the hand to seize it, and you find nothing." Charles, on the contrary, looked upon it as the summit of all earthly grandeur, and a means of obtaining a magical influence over the minds of nations. Francis I, King of France, was the second candidate. The young paladins of the court of this chivalrous sovereign were ever repeating that he ought, like Charlemagne, to be emperor of all the West, and reviving the exploits of the knights of old, attack the crescent that threatened the empire, crush the infidels, and recover the holy sepulchre. "You should convince the dukes of Austria that the imperial crown is not hereditary," said the ambassadors of Francis to the electors. "Besides, in the present state of affairs, Germany requires, not a youth of 19, but a prince who with a tried judgment combines talents already proved. Francis will unite the arms of France and Lombardy with those of Germany to make war on the Mussulmans. As sovereign of the Duchy of Milan, he is already a member of the empire. The French ambassadors strengthened their arguments by 400,000 crowns which they expended in buying votes, and in banquets which the guests generally quitted in a state of inebriation. Lastly, Henry VIII of England, jealous of the influence the choice of the electors would give Francis or Charles, also entered the lists. But he soon left these two powerful rivals to dispute the crown between them. The electors were not very favorably disposed towards either. "Our people," thought they, "will consider the King of France as a foreign master, and this master may wrest even from us that independence of which the great lords of his own kingdom have recently been deprived." As for Charles, it was an old maxim with the electors never to select a prince who already played an important part in the empire. The Pope participated in these fears. He was opposed to the King of Naples, his neighbor, and to the King of France, whose enterprising spirit alarmed him. "Choose rather one of yourselves," was the advice he sent to the electors. The Elector of Treves proposed to nominate Frederick of Saxony, and the imperial crown was laid at the feet of this friend to Luther. Such a choice would have gained the approbation of the whole of Germany. Frederick's wisdom and love for the people were well known. During the revolt of Erfurth, he had been advised to take the city by storm. He refused, that he might avoid bloodshed. "But it will not cost 5 men, was the reply. "A single man would be too many," answered the prince. It appeared that the election of the protector of the Reformation would secure the triumph of that work. Ought not Frederick to have seen a call from God in this wish of the electors? Who could have been better suited to preside over the destinies of the empire than this wise prince? Who could have been stronger against the Turks than a truly Christian emperor? The refusal of the Elector of Saxony, so extolled by historians, may have been a fault on the part of this prince. Perhaps to him must be partly ascribed the contests that devastated Germany in after days. But it is a difficult matter to decide whether Frederick deserves to be blamed for want of faith, or honored for his humility. He thought that the very safety of the empire required him to refuse the crown. "We need an emperor more powerful than myself to preserve Germany," said this modest and disinterested prince. "The Turk is at our gates. The King of Spain, whose hereditary possessions of Austria border on the threatened frontier, is its natural defender." The Roman legate, seeing that Charles would be elected, declared that the Pope withdrew his objections, and on the 28th of June the grandson of Maximilian was nominated emperor. "God," said Frederick not long after, "hath given him to us in his favor and in his anger." The Spanish envoys offered 30,000 gold florins to the Elector of Saxony, as a testimonial of their master's gratitude, but this prince refused them, and forbade his ministers to accept of any present. At the same time, he secured the liberties of Germany by a capitulation to which Charles's envoys swore in his name. The circumstances under which the latter assumed the imperial crown seemed, moreover, to give a stronger pledge than these oaths in favor of German liberty and of the work of the Reformation. This youthful prince was jealous of the laurels that his rival Francis I had gathered at Marignan. The struggle would still be continued in Italy, and the interval thus employed would doubtless suffice for the Reformation to gain strength. Charles quitted Spain in May 1520, and was crowned at Aix-la-Chapelle on the 22nd of October.